You're listening to Lab Notes, your weekly dose of inspiring innovation.
Hello and welcome to the Lab Notes podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Leo Stevens, and today is definitely a special occasion because you are here with me for the 50th episode of our show. To ensure we can properly commemorate this momentous occasion together, I've gone out and invested the Lab Notes budget in a horn for us to blow. So, ready? Alright, now as thrilling as that's been already, I'm sure you'll be very happy to learn that we're going to celebrate this milestone episode with some milestone-worthy guests as well. And while we were planning this 50th episode, something very fortuitous occurred, which was that I was invited to host a panel on deep tech investment as part of the Future Health Expo held at the University of New South Wales earlier in March. This panel included three fabulous guests who each have a wealth of experience in investing in university-based technologies at their earliest stages, from prospecting for IP at universities through detailed due diligence to forming and managing high-performing project teams all the way to their successful exits as trade sales or initial public offerings to the share market. I'm very pleased to say that the University of New South Wales kindly allowed me to record and share this live discussion with you, my podcast listeners, for our milestone episode. You can find more details about this event, our guests' bios, and future iterations of this expo series in the descriptions to this episode. But without any further ado, I'm pleased to introduce to you our three guests, which were Alejandra Romero from Main Sequence Ventures, Dr. Mian B., a practicing clinician and founder of Australian Medical Angels, and Dr. John Curick, the investment director and life science lead at Uniseed. And just like our usual interview episodes, I started by asking each of these guests for a quick introduction to themselves.
Hi everyone, I'm Alex Romero. I'm part of the Main Sequence Ventures team. Main Sequence came out of the CSIRO back in 2018, and we are a deep tech fund. We invest from pre-seed to Series B, and we like to get involved as early as possible. I'm actually sitting right next to one of my previous managers. I was before that with Uniseed, that is another early stage venture capital fund. So I've been in the space for quite a bit. I was exposed to the startup world before venture capital through a biotech startup for a bit. And in my previous life back in Europe, I had sales and marketing roles for the finance and design industries. I was the co-founder and manager of a non-for-profit for international migrant support. And my academic background is in biotech.
All right, so my name is B. I'm a clinician investor. I work as an ED doctor most of the days of the week and wear many other hats. So I've got a PhD in neuroscience, which I still dabble in. I run a multi-specialty clinic where we're delivering regional flying fly-out health model to in Tamworth. And I also run a 24,500 Facebook group of clinicians and doctors and dentists, focusing on educating them about how to invest their money and not be swindled of their money. And out of that group, together with my co-founder, Dr. Amandeep Pansra, we've created Medical Angels, which is a early stage angel investor syndicate looking to invest into health tech, med tech, and essentially the healthcare industry. So what we represent is that we're trying to mobilize this untapped source of capital, which is doctors' money, to invest in our own profession.
Brilliant. Thanks, B. And John?
Thanks, Leo. So I'm John from Uniseed. So we're Uniseed is a commercialization venture fund. So we're affiliated and work with 10 local universities, including five of the group of eight, including UNSW, as well as CSIRO. So we invest in new technologies coming out of those 11 partners across all faculty areas. I look after the life sciences portfolio specifically. So my background, I'm a neuroscientist. Actually, I tell people I'm onto my third career. So I started off as a neuroscientist, PhD in neuroscience back in the 1990s. So I'm showing my age, unfortunately. After a short academic career, then I moved across into the biotech sector and worked in a couple of local ASX-listed biotech companies in early-stage drug development. Did that for 10 years, had a sliding door moment and moved across onto the venture side. And I've been with Uniseed for 17 years this month, actually. So.
Okay, fantastic, guys. Now, I wanted to start this panel session with something a bit unusual, hopefully a bit of fun. I'm going to hit you with 10 quick fire questions around different concepts in investment or early stage startups. And I want you to explain them in 30 seconds or less. These questions will be open to anybody from the panel, so please just jump in a bit like a game show. The first question I'm going to hit you with is, what is the difference between a venture capitalist and an angel investor?
Angel is typically someone who would invest more with their heart than sense, I would think. They typically come in a lot earlier and tend to be more active, not so focused on a fund level approach to investing.
Any rebuttals?
A VC is a managed fund which has money from a number of investors and operates under a financial services license.
All right, great. What is IP?
IP, it represents unique ideas and work in a legal and consensuated way, I will say. And it allows researchers to sort of share it with the world and also benefit from it.
Equity?
Equity is basically the share that someone you would own of a company. For example, you can go and buy shares in public companies like Telstra, Qantas, Combank. On the VC side, equity is the same thing. You're buying shares in a company.
All right, they're getting harder now. What is an investment thesis?
Investment thesis is the way you invest, simply. There's different strategies, different ways where an investor will look at either a single investment or a group of investment. And, you know, we have probably a very different investment thesis to compare to most VCs.
What is due diligence?
It's homework. It's basically all the information you have to gather to make an appropriate investment decision. And it's sort of like balancing the pros and the cons and try to acknowledge the risk, but go ahead with it.
If I can use an American phrase, it's basically looking under the hood and making sure the engine works in simplistic terms.
Great. What is an investment round?
An investment round is basically an investor, whether it's a VC or an angel or a high net worth individual, writing a check and buying equity in a particular company. And that can happen over a number of periods of time as the company achieves its goals and its milestones.
What is a shareholder's agreement?
A shareholder's agreement is the set of rules that governs how a company operates.
Dilution?
It's very self-explanatory. It, basically, at the beginning of a company or through the journey of a company, you have to acknowledge that dilution will happen and you have to balance the fact that other investors will have to come into the round and you will be losing equity through it, but that will also allow to bring value and external money and validation. So you basically need to try to balance the cap table through the journey.
Right, second last, what is a board observer?
It's someone who doesn't make decisions at a board meeting, but sits there watching and learning and finding out what's happening.
All right, and finally, what is a portfolio company?
A portfolio company is basically one of several investments that a VC makes. For example, we've got at the moment 25 companies, I think, in our portfolio.
All right, so the segue here is perhaps obvious, but I'd love to get an example of a portfolio company from each of you, something that's really stuck out in terms of an idea or a piece of IP that's come to you and the founders you think are doing a great job of making a success of it. We'll go down the line now.
Okay,
Alex?
Okay. I will say Pending in AI. We invested in Pending AI in 2021-2022. And Pending AI is basically developing an AI tool to design and test new drugs. How it came to us, it was basically through an accelerator, sort of incubator. And to every team that we interact with, we always highly recommend that they actually go through these accelerator programs because it really shapes and gives the basic knowledge of how a startup will be formed and all the basic knowledge, basically saving you time and helping you with the business model, with the customer discovery and all that. So this team was at Cicada Innovations and they've been working on it for quite a bit of time. And we came across it at Cicada. How we generally operate when we look at an opportunity, even if it's more advanced or less advanced, we see if we like it at first. We try to sort of test the market size. And in this case, it was drug discovery. And as most of you know here, to take a drug to market, it will take, I think that is more than 10 years and more than $2 billion per drug. So they've demonstrated that they could reduce the cost and the time. So the market and the technology were validated. And through that, you sort of have to like engage with the team. This is a two-way street, you know, like your values, your mission and your vision has to be aligned. You're marrying your investor, you're marrying your founder, and you're signing for the like really like long-term journey. So you need to like each other. So through the due diligence process, you sort of like test the waters a little bit. And after that, you validate the IP, you see if it's valuable or not. The company will have set a valuation then, and you have to check if it's aligned with the market and with the technology milestones that they've set. And at that time, the milestones for the round, I think that they were quite reasonable, but also ambitious, and that's the right balance. We invested in them, and now they are reducing costs, reducing time, and also growing their customer pipeline. So,
brilliant. B?
I'm going to answer this question for Alex and myself. It's a co-investment that we've made with Main Sequence. It's a company called CoView. So anyone heard of Health Direct? Yeah. So at the start of the pandemic, when everyone was scrambling to move from face-to-face to telehealth, a company called CoView came out of CSIRO, which was originally supported by Main Sequence, and they won the Health Direct contract to deliver telehealth, not just to everybody, but also to provide the software for hospitals, for GP clinics. So if you did a telehealth consult during the pandemic, you probably used CoView. That was one of the companies that we invested sort of at the start of the pandemic and then quickly followed on because they needed the capital to expand. And so right now they're the biggest telehealth software platform in Australia. You know, I think as part of the COVID pandemic efforts, that's something I'm personally very proud of. And that's the kind of investments that we like to make at Medical Angels.
Fantastic. John, one that sticks out for you?
Yep, sure, absolutely. So the one that it's put it closest to my heart is a company called Canoxus Therapeutics, which has come out of the University of Sydney. So this is a company developing small molecule drugs in the neuropsychiatry space for addiction and social disorders. So we first saw this 2016 when it was still within the university. What we liked about it was basically a multidisciplinary team. We had the chemists from the Department of Chemistry making all the molecules are now working together closely with the neuropharmacologists at the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney, who were doing all the in vitro and in vivo assessments of the compounds. We invested in it. We led the round. We raised, I think at that time, was nearly $4 million. But there was no other VC interest at the time. And it was also at a time where generally there was not much interest in CNS drugs from big pharma companies, which probably scared off a number of investors. But that's come full circle now. I mean, at the moment, CNS is front and center, particularly since there's been recent approvals in Alzheimer's disease. Everybody's moved back in, and also people are moving in back into neuropsychiatry around autism, depression, schizophrenia. So we came in at the ground floor with an amazing group of scientists, and we've translated it now. We've completed the preclinical program, completed phase one safety in people, and we're now ready to commence multiple phase two clinical studies.
Brilliant, guys. Some fantastic examples there. And look, today I think we've all seen some of the amazing research IP that's on display from the University of New South Wales, and I'm sure many of the people who have self-selected to sit in this room are here because they have some aspiration to form a spin-out company or to somehow go on this journey of taking their IP out of a lab and into industry. I'd really love to help our audience understand what investors find to be a compelling opportunity, what the due diligence process looks and feels like, and how you prospect for ideas, how you come to this ecosystem of UNSW and the incredibly complex savanna we have here and find the ones that are going to be right for you.
How we sort of like find interesting IP and how we, okay. I think, well, we work across different research organizations, and I think that it's everywhere all the time and trying to be as exposed as you can. We like to engage with centers of excellence. We like to engage with tech transfer offices, with deans. We like to engage with researchers. And even if we are not investing in them at that time, we like to follow their journey and help them if we can, and maybe we'll join them, or like they will join us in a way. I think for a fund, like ours at least, you find time is gold. So you really need to be conscious of it. And we have six different challenge areas that we like to call. And one of them is actually based in healthcare. So to try to optimize as much as you can, you sort of try to find verticals that you are interested into and try to, I mean, different ways that is like see who is succeeding in the different research organizations at it, talking with people, talking with experts as much as you can. We like to be involved in all the different accelerators and support the different teams and act as mentors. We also do something that is called venture science, that is like a venture studio model, where if we find like really valuable IP, but maybe the researchers, you know, don't want to leave academia, or they are maybe not prepared to take this to the next stage yet, we'll get involved, bring all the commercial expertise, we'll bring the CEO as well, and we'll bring also an industry partner to act as a first customer and to sort of like validate and test the technology. And of course, we'll bring along the research organization that developed this. So we sort of like have strategized different ways of finding this valuable IP, but it's, you know, like it's a really tedious work and you have to be as exposed as you can. Maybe this is not IP so much, but it's more like what we've developed and what we've seen that we like within the healthcare space, like a list of checklists of things that we need to see. That is the target market has to be more of 1 billion. The team has to be super knowledgeable of the technology and of the market. Who's the customer? Who's going to pay for this technology? And they, of course, need to bring innovative IP to the table. And I guess that also it has to fit another checklist that is more wide or global, that is you need to reduce costs, you need to reduce time, you need to improve patients' experience and improve people's health.
B, can I frame this question in a slightly different way for you? Because I know you're an active clinician and so are most of the med angels. How do you think that shapes the way that you are investing in, and knowing that you are investing your own money, you kind of mentioned with heart, so what drives you to a particular technology or a particular investment?
Yeah, very good question. I think the most important thing, as Alex says, it's got to solve a problem. And how we approach things is that we look at a company from the problem it's trying to solve. And there's usually two kinds of companies. You know, one type of company is they have a nice solution and they're trying to fit it to a problem. And then there's companies where they start from a problem and then they have a solution to try and fix that problem. We much rather the latter, where they know what the problem is, they know how to fix it, and they're trying to fix it. Some of the companies that we've invested in are really damn boring, but it's vitally needed because they can either save time, you know, save costs, or streamline existing things to improve safety. And I think people who are working in the medical profession, that's something that's almost instinctive to us. So in a way, it's easier to market these sort of things to our investors because they understand what the problem is and they want to fix that problem. If you're going to solve a problem, someone will pay for it. So almost in a way that I guess the dollar and cents comes a little bit later because we know that this problem is worth fixing. And because we're not running a fund, we're investing our own money. It's about how much you believe in something. And I think that's what defines an angel investor versus any other kind of investor who's just looking for return.
John, I guess you've come with a lot of experience in the company structure and management, and obviously you're a very experienced VC fund in this space, probably more structured than an angel firm is. Are there particular nuances in the professional fund approach that you think shape the way that you do pick up investments and the sorts of processes that need to be followed?
Sure. I mean, so obviously, as a VC fund, we have a fiduciary duty to our shareholders. We operate under an AFSL license. But Uniseed is a little bit unique in that the universities that we're partnered with, they're all investors in the fund. So UNSW has invested their own money into the fund, and then in turn, we invest that back into new technologies coming from not just UNSW, but all our 11 partners. And we work very closely with the knowledge exchange team who present to us the opportunities. And as part of that arrangement, we have an equal first right look at all new IP that's generated from the University of New South Wales. That means that the university will show it to us at the same time they'll show it to other investors like my fellow panellists here. So in terms of our assessment process, I mean, we're technology agnostic. Obviously, we have to be because we're dealing with universities, so we look at things from all medical faculties and all, you know, departments and institutes, etc. But then our job as fund managers is to basically figure out, well, okay, which of those opportunities, is it a commercial opportunity in terms of, is there an unmet clinical need? Where does a therapy or device fit into clinical practice? Reimbursement? What's the size of the patient population? Patent position? Because obviously in the medical sciences, without a patent, you don't have a product. Working out, you know, what is the size of the market? And also thinking about it with the end in mind in terms of, okay, who's going to be the ultimate acquirer of the technology? So in terms of how we're going to make the venture return. So that means understanding what does pharma want? What are they looking to fill their pipelines in terms of drugs, different therapy areas, etc. And being on top of the current trends. And as I mentioned earlier, CNS is now back in vogue, whereas 5 years ago, it wasn't. Right. And obviously, we have developed process over the many years, sort of a checklist that you've got to sort of tick off and line up everything before you sort of make an informed investment decision as to whether you want to support the new venture.
Alex, I saw you pick up the mic.
Yeah, I think that we also like to be involved as early as possible, but we've also learned that we have to bring really early in the conversation that the company needs to evolve, and this is for everyone's benefit. And potentially and probably, the majority of the times, the person that develops the technology is going to be the right one for the first steps of the company. But sometimes to scale a technology at a really global level, maybe that person came out of the university recently and don't have the right expertise and skills to do that. And that's okay. That's totally fine. I always try to be super pragmatic about it and think, like, if you've created this, if this is your baby, and then in the coming rounds, you know, like you reach a point, you have to acknowledge that you are not the right person to take this to the next level. Let someone else do it, because this person is going to make you a millionaire probably. You know, like you still own that equity in the company and you find the time to actually do other things and let others drive that. So I don't think that is a bad thing. And we generally try to bring this conversation as early as possible because it can also bring tension. And as I said, this is a really long-term relationship and the last thing that you want is tension.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point for this deep tech translation space. And a lot of researchers are used to an environment where they have to do everything themselves, apply for the next grant, you know, work through all of the systems, learn all the new processes each and every time. So to some extent, maybe this is a relief, but also you're right, it is an interesting cultural shift. So I actually had a similar question lined up for John, so I might throw it back to you, John. It's essentially this question of, what is the preferred model for a startup based on research IP? Do we want to upskill the researchers to become entrepreneurs and follow the company? Or do you want to create professional management that will accept this intellectual property and carry it forward commercially while the researcher continues to do great research as an academic?
That's a great question, Leo. And I suppose there's a number of different components as part of that answer. So some VCs talk about, you know, they support the founders, you know, the founder model, the founders. Since we, you know, we work with universities, we like to say that we work with inventors. We consider the academics as the inventors of the science and the technology. And we have found over the years that the life sciences investments that we've done, most academics generally don't come out of the university and go into the venture on a full-time basis. They like to sort of stay in their laboratory or stay within the university. Not everyone does. And we find, particularly in the early stage of the venture, there's research being conducted back in the inventor's laboratory, you know, through the startup under a research agreement. And we do want to keep the inventor engaged and involved in the startup. And in most cases, they'll be engaged as a chief scientific officer or a chief technical officer. In our experience, when we make a new investment, we'll bring in an external project manager or CEO to run the venture. Because again, in our experience, we generally find that most academics don't have the right skill set to run the venture on a full-time basis. And you talked about upskilling. That's something that, you know, we're always looking to sort of do that, particularly, you know, to support academics who want to go down that entrepreneurial pathway. So you want to try to find a pathway for them to do that if they so choose. But again, I also like to sort of make the comment that our most successful companies have been run by people that have been professional CEOs. On the life sciences side, there is one exception where there was an academic who stepped out and ran the venture. It was successful, and we're backing him a second time. But generally, our experience is that the ventures have a better outcome where you have the professional manager. Because, you know, I think, as Alex mentioned, as the company grows, the skill set required to run the business changes as well. So that can mean you may go through several CEOs between when you do the initial seed investment or Series A to when the company does the commercial deal. You know, there may be several CEOs. And I can think of a couple of our companies. There's one that I think went through four CEOs from start to finish because, again, the skill set required changed over time and it was in everybody's interest, including, you know, the founding scientists, that you had the best people running the business to get the best outcome.
Can I just add something? I think when you talk about a professional CEO, we got to differentiate that between who's actually running the show versus and who's out there fundraising. Personally, I love the founders that can actually come out and fundraise together either by themselves or with a professional CEO, because there's nothing I hate more when I ask a non-scientific professional CEO about the science and they say, oh, I got to get back to you.
No, you're 100% correct. Yeah, I mean, with our companies, both on the life sciences and on the tech side, the academic founder will definitely go out on the fundraising with the CEO as part of that process. Absolutely.
You'd be surprised at how that's not always the case, and it can be a bit difficult. And so, like, I think it's often good to also teach the scientific or the medical founder at least some basics in the process rather than completely outsourcing that to a professional CEO.
And again, if I sort of use the example of Canoxus Therapeutics, what I talked about earlier, one of the academic founders is employed as the chief scientific officer. He's still got a small role within the university and, you know, he's been actively involved in the fundraising process.
Sorry, Alex, did you want to come in on that as well? Or?
I was actually going to praise UNSW because here they are quite good at actually integrating that research and innovation conversation. And I think that it's a matter of like changing the landscape and the mindset in everyone's mind. And
Well, I've been here 2 months, but I'll take personal credit. Thank you. So can I take a step back and talk about, I guess, the research labs and the research direction and how we can optimize that for success down the road? Because a lot of these researchers are also considering what their prospects would be like to do a research in one direction or another. Do you have any advice to researchers on how they can set themselves on the right path to ensure the research that they are undertaking has a viable pathway beyond the lab?
I think every time that I come to the university and, for example, when I engage with the tech transfer office and I check the list of the technology that is coming out of the different universities, there's really, really valuable IP. And sometimes you see something that is a fantastic opportunity, but for a venture perspective, maybe it's not the right fit. And when I see the right fit, it's not the right target market. We need to reach our own internal milestone. So even if we really like something, even if the IP is super exciting and it will be life-changing, there are opportunities that we have to miss because the target market is not the right one. And it's quite devastating, actually, in healthcare when you are approaching different things and you see that you can actually solve a problem, but it's the nature of the beast, like to say. For someone that is trying to go from academia in spin-out process, I'll say have the market in mind and understand that that's what people are looking for. Have a really global mindset. Australia is a fantastic market, but if you really want to succeed with your startup and with your opportunity, you have to look abroad and understand that you need to test your technology overseas to actually make it succeed. Be as exposed as possible to everything that is happening in places like here. That is a fantastic launching pad, you know, workshops, accelerators, events like this. And also reach out to investors. And if you have an idea, people are going to be willing to listen to you and to give you feedback of what they know. You know, at the end of the day, this is something that we are all trying to build, and it's not a competition.
I'm going to be a bit of a downer here, and I'm just going to say that to all the academics, clinicians out there, it's okay to not want to commercialize research because not all research is commercializable. And you got to find your purpose in even just the pure pursuit of knowledge. Because if you've got something which is very interesting, which is good research, but it's really not commercializable, it doesn't mean that you failed as an academic or a researcher. I think that's something very important because, you know, we're all celebrating startups and we're getting very excited. Not everything is possible to go on this startup journey. Not everything needs to go on this journey. And just because someone else has done it and you haven't doesn't mean anything about how good or how bad a researcher you are. I think that's very important in all this glitz and glamour.
I mean, I think I was going to say something very similar. So I think, you know, the message is don't ignore the basic research because all the big health problems are solved by doing the basic research first. And then from that, the research translation will happen.
Can I ask a question a little bit about the pathway to market for a lot of medical technologies? I might start with this one with you, B. As a clinical professional, you know the lead times that go into getting a new product into this system. How should a researcher or an entrepreneur go about testing and validating their idea? There is all these safety and regulatory concerns to layer onto the MVP fast fail kind of model.
Look, I think the safety, you know, the TGA, the FDA, those are safety barriers. So you got to end up proving that whatever you're doing is safe or whatever you're claiming is accurate. It doesn't stop you from validating whether your problem is worth solving or not. And I think one of the most important things is you got to go out, speak to the people who will end up using your product. It doesn't have to be perfect. It could be a pre-MVP even, and just talk to the people who you think you're going to market to, because sometimes they can see a lot more than you haven't. And to be very honest, I think a lot of the regulatory stuff that's outside of the clinical trial space is surmountable if you give it enough time. And obviously it depends on what your product is. If you're a pharmaceutical and you need to prove efficacy and you need to prove that this does X, Y, and Z, then yes, there's a huge risk to that and you have to do that. So that's why usually small molecules, pharmaceuticals are very, very deep tech because the risk is humongous. But if you've got a device that does something better, it just has to be safe. And most of the time that can be solved if you put enough time and sort of structure into it.
Any other thoughts on regulatory pathways and advice to deep tech?
Oh, look, I was going to say, drug development, if I use that as an example, you know, it's highly regulated, but the process is very prescriptive. So you go from preclinical phase one, phase two, phase three, et cetera. It's all sort of set out for you. So I think as a researcher, I wouldn't get too bogged down on that, although it's good to have a basic understanding of what the process is and how long it takes and what you need to do, because some of those early safety studies you can generally build into your research translation project, funding permitting. But I think, if you're an academic researcher here, particularly one of the medical faculties, you know, you would be surrounded by academic clinicians, and it's all about speaking to those people to understand what the clinical gap is and where your research may fit into clinical practice.
For the regulatory bit, I will only say that engage with advisors as early as possible, because we've seen many cases of technologies that have been validated, they've engaged with the FDA, they engaged with the TGA, and then there's something, there's a little thing that has changed in the last like 2-3 months that slows down the process for another 6 months. So don't be afraid to be testing your technology constantly with advisors and with the public, because that will save you time for sure.
Hi everybody, I hope you've been enjoying this discussion so far. I just wanted to jump in at this moment because we're going to change pace a little. At this point during the live recording, we started to accept audience questions which were put to the panel. Now, because we don't have the consent of these audience members to use their voice, I'm going to re-voice those questions and then return to the panel's answers. So with that out of the way, the first question we received from the audience was trying to get an explanation of what equity or remuneration would be available to a professional manager who might join a project, and as a related part of that, what type of dilution or loss of control might researchers expect to see in the project as it transitions from an academic project to a commercial operation?
I'll give a crack to the first one. I think that ESOP and equity from the early days is quite important. And if you are bringing in a really relevant CEO to the table, you have to engage with them and give them the right amount of equity and give them the right amount of salary if you are confident that it's going to take the company to the right level. And it's a case-by-case thing, and it also depends on the type of investors that are involved. It depends on the research organization and which sort of a facilities you are using. So I don't think that is a one size fits all, but as you were asking before, like what the shareholders agreement do, like it's like a rule book for how to be fair and try to be in the conversation of like what's fair as early as possible and not try to go around the back, because I think that what people don't like is surprises. So just try to be as open as possible and ask what everyone's expectation is from the very beginning.
So on now to the second audience question, which related to what were the common failure points for university spin-outs, and were there any common themes in how, when, and why a university spin-out failed?
I think one of the common stuff is founder disagreements. And you got to have a mechanism for people to exit. You know, when you raise a new round, you got to revest all of the founder equities. What I mean by revesting is that after you take on investment, the founder can't just decide they don't want to do it anymore and still keep their holding. So you got to slowly give that back to them over time. And I think not structuring an exit clause into the initial founder's agreement, you know, we've seen that happen a number of times where people wanted to leave and it's not structured in. And obviously the person wanting to leave said, no, I want to still hold on to everything. And everyone else is like, no, that's not fair. And then it causes a lot of problem and angst amongst, you know, old investors and new investors. And I think that's, you know, the more people you have, the more problem it causes.
Yeah, I mean, to add to that, I would sort of bring it back a step. One thing that's very, very, very important for us before we make any investment is to make absolutely sure that there's total alignment between everybody. That is us as investors, the academic inventor or the founder, the project manager that we may bring on board, etc. There has to be total alignment. And that sort of goes to something that we just mentioned now. Because once you make the investment, all those people have to work together for a period of time. And we've seen cases where things have unraveled very, very quickly because there's been no alignment. And that's a lose-lose for everybody.
Yeah, I want to add to that. And in some industries, you almost got to do due diligence on the person. And in VC, we don't do that as much compared to like PE guys, because like, you know, they deal with industries like waste management where someone might have like doing lots of dodgy stuff in the background. So I think we're lucky that we don't have to deal with that kind of crowd.
I was going to say that the common problem for why companies fail, it's generally people's problem. And that's the common statement. It's the startup world is a very tense world, and we are human, so that's how it works. But yeah, it's definitely people.
And on now to our final audience question, which came from a researcher who was doing some work in a niche area, one that she felt would be applicable to a very small number of end users, but might have a lot of value to those people. And the question here was around what pathways were available to niche discoveries like that, that might not be suitable for venture scaling, but nevertheless did have a market opportunity, or at least a market that was worth addressing.
I can answer that question. You're absolutely right. There's lots of stuff that makes sense, but are not venture scalable, and they should not be seeking venture investments. And this is where angel investors, family offices, or industry investors come into play. For instance, if you have a technology that makes cloning easier, for instance, right? Sometimes that's not venture scale. You're not going to get that multiplier 100x, you know, unicorn status, but it doesn't mean your research is worthless. Just means that you need to look for a different kind of investor, whether that can be financed through debt and equity, or family offices, other angel investors. And it's difficult to find these people because they're not advertising themselves on the AFR or being published in the newspapers every day. But these people definitely do exist. And it's about asking around and finding those kind of investors, which is a bit harder. But I think rather than bumping ahead against VCs trying to get money when your company's not VC scale or VC type, that's the best way to go about it.
And foundations as well, I'll say. And this is something terrible that we face every time that we see something that is life-changing for a certain part of the population, but that, you know, it doesn't make sense for us, but it does make sense to the world. But there's definitely options out there. And what I've seen is foundations, and they're in Australia, they are really wealthy ones, but also internationally, and they are really well connected between each other.
I mean, and there are dedicated impact investment funds for that exact purpose that you talked about.
So I know we're out of time, guys. I'm sorry that I'm going to have to draw this to a close because there's plenty more territory that we could cover. But please join me in thanking our three panelists here. They've been fantastic guests. Of course, you can check out MedAngels, Uniseed and Main Sequence Ventures online to get more information about their process and how to apply. And also you can get in touch with UNSW Industry and Innovation. If you've got a great idea, we're here to help you through the process. Thanks, everybody.
Well, that's it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this special milestone episode. You can check the description for our guests' bios for more information about the University of New South Wales and the Future Expo series. There's another expo coming up in May focused on climate and clean technology, so please jump in and see if you would like to attend that in person. As always, Lab Notes is a production of Eon Labs, and this special episode was co-produced with the University of New South Wales. The music is sourced from Purple Planet Music and mixed by Dr. Nat Harris. See you next time.